This is Vermont Edition. I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Bob Kinzel. Last year, researchers at a national think tank analyzed racial disparities in the country's criminal justice system. Their findings were stark. According to the study by the Sentencing Project, Black Americans nationwide are incarcerated at more than five times the rate of white people. And almost nowhere is that rate more lopsided than in Vermont, where Black people are jailed at a rate more than 10 times greater than those of whites. Locally based studies have yielded similar findings. Work conducted by a University of Vermont researcher last year showed that Vermonters of color are far more likely to be pulled over by police and also to have their car searched when they're stopped. The statistical evidence is irrefutable at this point. Vermont has glaring racial disparities in its policing, and the impacts are being felt across the criminal justice system. Legislation introduced in Montpelier this year represents a new attempt to try to deal with that problem. The Racial Justice Bill, as it's known in the State House, would create a new board to oversee issues of racial justice in Vermont. The legislation also calls for sweeping reforms of oversight of law enforcement officers. We are joined today in Vermont Edition by Mark Hughes. He is an advocate for racial justice and also the founder of Justice for All, a Vermont-based nonprofit that's working to identify and dismantle institutionalized racism. Mark, thanks so much for being with us here today.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Mark, there are two identical racial justice bills circulating in Vermont right now. One is in the Senate. The other is in the House. There's a lot in this legislation, but give us a quick overview of some of the key components of this bill and what they do.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for having me on the program, and I wanted to also acknowledge just a lot of folks that made this possible. There's nine board members behind me. There's four folks that are out there working hard with certain teams that are in the field with Justice for All. But then there's other folks who are under the Golden Dome. I want to give a special thanks to our pro tem and also the chairman of the judiciary and the Senate, as well as the House. Senators Sears and Grad, very, very productive conversations that I've had with them. And I wanted to point out the fact that, some of the other leadership, like, Speaker of the House and even those who've taken the time to put this bill together, we've got a great group of folks in the Senate who are working on it. And, I think it's very important to have this conversation when you have Dick Sears and Joe Benning and Jeanette White and Alice Nitka and Tim Ash. All those guys are working very hard in examining these things. This bill, when it was put forward in the Senate as well as in the House, it was already decided that this was necessary because, we got to think about this thing. We don't put bills forward that we don't think are important. So there's a lot of folks that are out there. Kaya Morris led the charge on the House side, And so I really appreciate Representative Morris's work there, and then definitely our own in Washington County, Senator Anthony Polina. So there's a lot of folks to talk about here, and so this doesn't have anything to do with just me or Justice for All. There's also a very large coalition, which you can see out on the website there.
It sounds like you've got a lot of people to try to generate as much momentum as possible for this legislation.
Yeah.
What exactly would it do, Mark?
Well, the legislation in a nutshell is the establishment of a board, and I just want to back the conversation up a little bit, because what we're talking about here is we're not talking about, increasing the oversight of law enforcement. God knows we've been doing that. We've been trying that really hard. And I think much to their consternation for the last several years. And I don't think it's fair to law enforcement for us to continue to look to them to solve a system problem. So what we're really looking at is the establishment of a board, and the reason that board is being established is to provide the oversight of the implementation of various processes, mitigation processes throughout the entire criminal justice system. Yes, we've had this conversation about fair and impartial policing for a while. Let's not forget that what happened here is after the two reports that went to the Civil Rights Commission, one in schools and one for racial profiling back as early as the late 90s. What we had was coming out of those four agencies in Burlington, South Burlington, UVM, and I believe the other one might have been Winooski. those law enforcement officers, those police chiefs stepped up and they said, hey, we got problems here. So this has already been known. We didn't need Stephanie Seguino to bring it up to our attention at the beginning of this year, nor Ashley Nellis at the beginning of last year. So we've been working on this since 2012 and before. But the legislation, Act 134, came out in 2012, and it was entitled Racial Disparities in the Criminal Justice System. So this is the system approach has not been this is not a new approach. We've walked it back over the last several years. We introduced Act 193 in 2014, which was called Fair and Impartial Policing. And we decided, instead of looking across the entire system, instead of answering questions like, you know, how do we report misconduct to the concerning law enforcement across the state, or is sentencing incarceration, are there disparities there and what do we do about them? Instead of answering questions about, you know, what do we do about our prosecutors and our judges, what we did is we decided it would be easier to focus on our law enforcement. I think we've done a fairly good job, but okay, enough already. Let's get what we've decided to implement for law enforcement in, and let's get it in properly. But then let's extend data collection, race data collection. Let's extend this policy. Let's extend training. Because if implicit bias exists with law enforcement, then it's got to exist across the rest of the system. Let's start these processes across the remainder of the system, and then let's get some oversight in there. And does that mean that there are going to be some processes that could potentially be adjusted? Maybe there may be some processes that are currently in place that may have ownership in other places. Well, we're making some fundamental changes here. This is called racial justice reform, okay? So we're making some fundamental systemic changes. So we may have to move some processes around to make this work. But I don't want this bill to be sold as something that's once again coming after law enforcement.
Mark, as you mentioned, the bill proposes the establishment of a 12-member racial justice oversight board. That would be the name of it. It would be housed in the office of the Attorney General.
That's correct.
The idea is it's going to address some of the issues related to institutionalized racism in the criminal justice system. What kind of authority do you envision this board having?
Well, the authority that the board is going to have is basically spelled out there in the legislation. There's a number of activities and authorities that the board is going to be entrusted with. I think the main thing is that what we want to focus on is the fact that it's going to conduct the management and the oversight of the implementation of racial justice reform across the state. Okay, so that's going to be variable. I think the what's more important is the composition of the board. This is going to be, the composition of the board is going to be across, you know, various agencies. You know, I just had a conversation with Karen Richards, who's the executive director of the Human Rights Commission. She'll be on that board. Rick Gauthier, the executive director of the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council. We've been in constant communication. We've worked very closely. He or a designee will be a member of that board. Yeah, there will be a representation from the state's attorney's offices and the executive director, state's attorneys, and sheriffs, and of course the attorney general's office himself. I think what's more important about that board also is where that board resides, and it's under the office of the attorney general. So let's talk. Let's talk brass tacks here. What we're really talking about here is we're talking about a fundamental way of doing things differently. There's a lot of concern. I'm hearing, and there's a lot of discussion about the law enforcement's play in this. But really, what we want to be talking about more than anything is the fair and impartial policing policy. Quite frankly, because it's the centerpiece of everything that we're doing here with as it pertains to law enforcement. It's the conversation of S-79. It's the conversation of the guidance that was released earlier this week by our attorney general. And I think that the implementation of these processes, you know, with that at the core of it from a policing perspective, and also with with that particular intent across the remainder of the system, and that is to say, let's treat everyone fair. That's really what this is all about. So whatever those authorities are, I'm assuming that we're going to be changing, you know, as we evolve. The board will be changing as it evolves. So I think to take the deep dive into this right now, it potentially could just derail the entire intent and the conversation. I think the high level is fairness and impartiality. We've got something to fix. and we just got to do the right thing.
You talk about fair and impartial policing, Mark, and obviously that's a big goal of this bill. What are some specific mechanisms that you think the state can use to advance fair and impartial policing policies in this state?
Well, again, I really don't think that this conversation is about fair and impartial policing. I think the policy is at the center of the conversation, but the conversation is about how do we implement mechanisms across this state to ensure that we reduce disparities in the criminal justice system. Okay, sure, those activities that are ongoing in policing, I think they can serve as a model. We can look at the United States Attorney General under Loretta Lynch's leadership, and we saw that there was a policy and training and data collection and oversight that was coming down. We look at the president's final report on 21st century policing, which the Vermont League of Cities and Towns has adopted and has been incorporated in the processes of many enforcement agencies across the state. All of this stuff is not new. So I think in terms of what that looks like, what are those tools? And again, we're talking about systemic racism, institutionalized racism. What those tools look like is, again, it's policy. It's model policy. It's not fair and impartial policing policy. It's model policy, because implicit bias is implicit bias. It doesn't make any difference what uniform you wear or what office you report to. Model training for implicit bias it should be model training for implicit bias. It shouldn't make any difference what kind of job we have at the end of the day. That model training should be model training. Data collection, we figured that out with law enforcement. Great. Let's go ahead and figure out how we go about, solidifying, the point of aggregation and correlation of that data and making it publicly available for all 69 agencies across the state. How about that? But in addition to that, let's go and identify where that data resides, where they reside in these other particular parts of the criminal justice system. We all know that within the prosecutor's office, which is the blackest box in the entire system, that there are decision making points where very high levels of discretion are provided. And what we need to do is no pun intended, collect some black white data there. And we need to begin measuring our progress again in that system as well, whether it's plea deals, whether it's sentencing or incarceration length or whatever those numbers are. I think it's going to require some discovery. There's a few things that we don't know about what we're trying to get done here. But I think we should also understand that there should be similar activities in terms of the Defender General's office, our judges, and as well as across the corrections. That's what we need to do to correct this problem. It's indefensible that we have 1 in 14 African-American males incarcerated in this state, leading the nation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a racial justice bill that would make some major changes to a number of areas in Vermont, the criminal justice system among them. It would establish a separate prosecutor for alleged police misconduct in parts of the bill. It would also create a new police oversight board. Just ahead, Vermont's top law enforcement officer will weigh in. This is Vermont Edition.
We're doing something special this month, and we're asking you to help spread some podcast love. So I want you to think about a person in your life. Maybe a parent, a friend, your farmer, your vet, your neighbor, your barista, and recommend a podcast you think that person would really like listening to. Show them how to listen and to subscribe if they're new to this whole podcasting thing. And then hop on social media and tell us what show you recommended. You can use the hashtag TryPod, that's TryPod. And thanks for spreading the love.
I'm Peter Hirschfeld, and this is Vermont Edition. The Racial Justice Oversight Board is the centerpiece of a bill that's been introduced in Montpelier that tries to get at the problem of racial disparities in policing. That's our focus today on Vermont Edition. Our guests are Mark Hughes, founder of Justice for All and a longtime racial justice advocate. This legislation suggests profound changes to how we oversee police work in Vermont, and we wanted to get the perspective of the state's top law enforcement officer. This week, I spoke with Attorney General T.J. Donovan about the racial justice bill, and I asked him, does he think the state needs an independent body to prosecute alleged police misconduct?
I don't think so, Pete. I support the premise of the bill. I don't support that aspect of the bill, and I'm going to tell you why. In terms of reviewing those officer-involved shootings, you have two different offices that have the jurisdiction to look at that in terms of use of force. You have your local state's attorney office as well as the attorney general's office. And I think when those two concurrent investigations are going on, you have a couple different sets of eyes to look at this, whether or not the use of force was justified. So I think creating and, frankly, paying for an independent prosecutor to address this is not necessary at this time. We have the structure in place with the state's attorneys and the attorney general's office.
But your office's ability to execute its duties, Attorney General Donovan, requires a close relationship with members of the law enforcement community, and critics of the existing oversight apparatus say that compromises your ability to investigate those allegations against police in a fair and impartial manner.
Well, I disagree. You know, when you look, the law is clear in terms of looking at use of force and take these officer-involved shootings. And I've made these decisions. And I think what we've been able to do is to be incredibly transparent in terms of outlining the reasons for our decision in cases where we've ruled the use of force justified. Other times, we've charged police officers because we do it by the facts of the case and by the law. And the relationship with law enforcement does exist. The role of the prosecutor is to be a check on the police. Certainly, we work together, but there is that healthy tension, that positive tension between the police and prosecutors, as it should, because the job of the prosecutor isn't just a rubber stamp. It is to scrutinize. It is to be a gatekeeper, and it is to be that honest broker in terms of holding people accountable. And I think in this state, where we're a small state, that if there is that conflict that arises, you have the ability to recuse one office and go to perhaps a different state's attorney's office. And you also have the attorney general's office that by design is more removed from local law enforcement.
Finally, Attorney General Donovan, another key element of this racial justice bill deals with the gathering of roadside stop data. You yourself have said the state needs a more comprehensive mechanism for collecting some of that data to try to identify racial disparities in police work and ultimately root them out. Do we need legislation to make that happen?
I don't think we need legislation. I mean, it is happening. Professor Stephanie Seguino just released a report earlier this winter summarizing her outcome study on the motor vehicle race data collection.
Also, we should note, though, talking about some of the systemic failures going on right now in police agencies across the state in compiling that data.
Well, that's the point where legislation is going to be needed, Pete. I think the collection is happening for many departments. I think what we want to make sure is that everybody is doing the collection and that they have the tools and resources to do the collection. One of the concerns I have, when you get to some of these smaller departments, they may not necessarily have the resources or the tools to properly collect the data, but we got to make sure that those tools are available for them to do that. And I do think legislating this is appropriate.
Mark Hughes, you hear T.J. Donovan there talking about elements of this bill, some he's very supportive of, some he has some concerns with. What do you make of what you hear of T.J. saying about this?
That's good. I'm sorry we have to only focus on law enforcement. But first of all, let me just provide a little clarification. What you said at the end of the last segment is that the bill was proposing a statewide oversight of civilian oversight of law enforcement and also processes and methodologies for independent prosecution. And I'm sorry, Peter, that's not true. What the bill actually is calling for is a report back to the General Assembly with recommendations on those. So that is not a component of this bill in terms of what it is that we're trying to get done today. This committee would come back with recommendations, and then TJ would have his time to argue that point, you know, once these recommendations came forward. So let's not get too quick to throw this thing out before we even have the opportunity to come back with recommendations.
Fair enough,
so,
Mark.
So
absolutely.
Wait a minute.
Good
so
point.
Let me just go ahead and make some further clarification, because if we want to talk about the authority of this bill, I don't want this bill to be misrepresented. Okay. First of all, I shouldn't have to be representing this bill right now, because we've got a lot of fine senators and representatives who already think that this bill should be happening. And I think
many sponsors in both the House and Senate, we
absolutely
should say.
Absolutely, and to include TJ himself, because he's set with us to get this thing done. So
yep.
I want the general public to understand that TJ is behind this bill, and I think that was the first thing he said. So let's be very specific, you know. Thanks for putting me on the hot seat, because you just made me do my homework. So here's what's going on here is this bill, what it's doing is it says it's supposed to ensure that law enforcement are in compliance with Statute 2023-66. That is the policy work. Now, it's supposed to review the data collected by the state, okay? It's also, now get this, it's supposed to provide recommendations to the Criminal Justice Training Council and the Vermont Bar Association on model training and policy for law enforcement, prosecutors, defender generals, or public defenders, judges, correctional officers, and to recognize and address implicit bias, I'm reading, and conduct oversight of the statewide adoption of the implementation of policies and training. So those are the first three authorities that the bill is proposing. The others are to provide recommendations to the council on model training and policy for use of force, which is not happening at all across this state. Okay. And also in collaboration with the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council to oversee implicit bias, basic training and refresher training. There's just a couple more.
I want to delve into those in a second. We actually have Representative Kaya Morris on the line now. Kaya Morris is a representative from Bennington. She's a sponsor of this bill. Kaya, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much.
Why was this legislation that you wanted to sponsor?
Well, I think it's really, really important for folks to understand. They feel that I think many times we pass legislation and sometimes it feels like it's feel good. But really what we're trying to do is to ensure that our state is functioning as it should be, that it's representative of the needs and the concerns and the changing tides of what's happening within our state. And so we went about this process of looking at all of these different elements. Policing being one area, our justice system being another area. We also have disparities within housing, within education, within employment. And we pass these policies saying, fix this, but then have no real oversight or review of that process. So this is meant to try to really help support the work that's being done to be done more efficiently. So what we found is we passed our fair and impartial policing update, basically saying, everybody, please, come on, let's get it together here, and received reports in our Senate and our House committees that not everything is being fully implemented. There's major struggles that areas are having with their data collection and their submission. There's concerns about how the data is being utilized. There's a number of different elements that need to be looked at, and someone needs to do that. So this was really trying to create a mechanism for doing that, as well as creating a mechanism for greater transparency and communication around that work by ensuring that there's actual residents that are part of this body that is seeking to do this. We're not trying to create an additional layer of government, nor one to just be specifically focused on what's happening within our criminal justice system. However, there's a great deal of work that needs to be done. So I think that this, it makes sense. It truly makes sense. I think it's not fair for us as the state to say, UVM, please keep using your resources and see what you can get to make this work. This is the work that we need to do ourselves and ensure that it's being done with whomever community partners can be a part of that process. So I think it's really important right now as we're talking about these issues, and especially with what's happening on the national landscape, to ensure that the values that we have said as a legislature that we believe are supposed to be here within our state remain so and remain strong. And so we want to make sure that there are mechanisms for delivering on that promise. And I think that this bill offers a mechanism for creating an infrastructure to do just that.
Kaya Morris, you're in the State House every day, and I imagine you've been talking to fellow legislators about this bill. What do prospects look like for the bill this year as it's constituted right now?
It looks very positive. It makes sense. This is common sense legislation for work that everyone says, yes, we actually did ask you to do this. we did compel the we came from the legislature and unanimously passed these bills to say, we think this needs to get done. So it makes sense to have some way of ensuring that this work is being done and that the struggles are being addressed, so that we can have success in the work that we're trying to do.
And Mark, we have about a minute left. What are your hopes for what's going to happen with this legislation as we move into the next phase of the legislative session?
Peter, I think we're going to see the bill cross over. I think that I just want to just thank Kaya, for the work that she's doing. I think we're going to see this happen. We've got a lot of folks that are excited about it. I hope to see everybody out for the rally at 6 p.m. On Thursday, and also for the press conference at 10 on Wednesday at the State House. This is going to happen. I think we can do this together. There's a lot of negotiation that's going on, and I think this is the best thing for the state. So thank you for your time, and thanks for having us on the program. I look forward to seeing you at the State House.
Well, thank you, Mark Hughes. Mark Hughes is a racial justice advocate and the founder of Justice for All. Representative Kaya Morris of Bennington is one of three sponsors of the racial justice bill in the House that we've been discussing this hour. Thank you both for being with us this hour. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Bob Kinzel. We've been talking this hour about ways that lawmakers are trying to address racism in Vermont's police and criminal justice system. We're the second whitest state in the country, and that can lead to two areas of friction when we talk about problems of race. The predominantly white population doesn't always see that the problem exists, and the relatively small population of people of color can feel both highly visible and deeply isolated. These are some of the themes that became evident when the VPR podcast Brave Little State took on the question of Vermont's whiteness. The program was reported and produced by Angela Evansy with Rebecca Sinanis. The three of us talked yesterday about how fraught the question of racism can be in a state that's 95% white. Angela, your reporting took on a question that was asked by a listener, Eva Gumprecht.
Why is Vermont so overwhelmingly white? And how does that affect all of us?
And Eva's questions get to the idea that other places in the country have seen their demographics change dramatically from white to brown to white to black. Angela, what are some of the historical forces that led to Vermont being such a white state in the first place?
So there are a couple macro historical forces that we can point to help answer this question of Eva's. I talked to Sam McReynolds. He's a professor of sociology at the University of New England in Maine. He's pointed out what is probably seems like the most obvious part of this answer, the fact that Vermont was one of the first states to abolish slavery. And he says, because of that, because there was no huge cotton plantations, for example, there was never just a baseline established community of African Americans.
There were no jobs. There was no African American history, heritage, culture to attract Africans, Americans to come to the state. My view is that not just for Vermont, but for northern New England, for New Hampshire and Maine as well, that the situation was structured in a way that without large-scale farming, without large-scale industry, without having had a slave population to deal with large-scale farming, there simply wasn't a foundation or a base for drawing people in.
So again, that was Sam McReynolds, a professor of sociology at the University of New England. And the other thing that Sam talked about in terms of, huge movements of people that Vermont didn't get was in terms of industrialization. So in the 19th, 20th centuries, our whole region saw incredible industrialization, including Vermont, right? We had things like granite and marble quarries and mills. But the people that came to take those jobs were immigrants from Europe. They were French Canadians. They were Irish and Italian and Swedish. And the sort of huge, it's called the Great Migration, this huge, like millions of people, millions of African Americans moving up out of the American South, they didn't come to Vermont because those jobs were taken by other people. So those were two of the kind of macro forces that I learned about from Sam.
Rebecca, you've been reporting on the lived experience of people of color in Vermont. Why did you feel like it was so important to pay attention to individuals' stories?
Well, we can only know our own experiences, and those are experiences that I personally haven't had. So I felt it was important to amplify voices that are actually experiencing these things, who are also, you know, full, well-rounded Vermonters living all sorts of experiences, but they do live in a racialized state in a way that maybe somebody who isn't a person of color does not. So one of the people of color that I spoke with said to me, "At what point do we meet your quota?" And I thought that was really striking because although this is a predominantly white state, there are people of color here, and they are affected by the racial makeup of this state, and they do have voices and they do have experiences that matter. And I thought that amplifying those voices were important because perhaps it's not a story of Vermont that we hear often enough. One of the first people I interviewed is Sharana Henderson. She moved here when she was 19. Here she is.
I've never been in an area that was so white. I've never been somewhere where I was constantly stared at and pointed at and where my boundaries were definitely tested. So in the spring of 2009, I moved here with my son's father. He's originally from White River Junction, and I was pregnant. And we were going over names, and my son's name is Hayden. But we had a few names. We had Micah, we had Malcolm, which was my favorite, and Darrell. But I brought it up to someone that one of the names I really wanted to name him was Malcolm. The look on their face was almost like just pure disappointment, and they had probably known me for like a day. They said, well, that name is going to be really hard for him because it's going to disable him in the future as a person of color. You should stick with something easy like Sean or John. And that really hurt me because my name is Sharana. I'm not Sarah. I'm not Jane. You know, my name is Sharana. So it kind of did some self-reflecting on me to realize to me that was just flat out racist. Everyone is completely baffled about why I live here. I've had one friend, just one, come to visit me from New York. And my mother comes up often, but she doesn't like to because she feels extremely isolated. It's hard for her to see my son grow up with just surrounded by children who are not like him. And he can identify partially to them, but not completely.
That was Sharana Henderson.
Angela, in your reporting, you talked with a number of people in the academic community about how the economic and cultural forces that made Vermont white are also still at work to keep the state fairly homogenous. How so?
Yeah, this was a really interesting part of the quote-unquote answer to learn about, because the forces that are kind of colliding right now are much more complicated. So, for example, I talked to an associate professor of sociology at Middlebury College named C. Winter Hahn, and he pointed out that, you know, there are a lot of historically predominantly white states in our country that are now diversifying at a much faster rate than Vermont is. He uses Iowa as an example. He told me about how in that state there's this burgeoning meatpacking industry that's attracting a ton of Latino labor. And he points out, you know, in Vermont we don't have the equivalent of that because we don't have these large-scale agricultural operations, right? We're much more focused on small-scale farming, community agriculture. And this is where kind of our economy and our politics start to rub up against each other in really interesting ways. And so the larger point here is because Vermont doesn't have these large-scale economies and industries that require really, really big workforces, a ton of workers, there has never been a demand for that many workers. And if there were, I think what Professor Hahn is saying is, you know, that workforce would be inherently more diverse. But because the more typical Vermont business hires a couple people, a dozen people, there's never been a huge pull for labor for these sort of contemporary Vermont industries.
And Angela, what are we even talking about when we talk about what it means to be white?
That's a really good question because I think a lot of us are walking around with sort of a very simplistic definition of whiteness and Vermont whiteness, but it is a really, really loaded word and concept. So I talked to one researcher who had dug into this idea of the more cultural whiteness of Vermont. There's sort of a very strong association, for example, with Yankees in this state. And I bet when you think of a Yankee, you think of a white person. And it's not just an appearance. It's sort of like a way of behaving and a way of talking and a certain set of values. And that kind of layer of our state identity has been kind of buttressed over the years in really interesting ways, too, in terms of the state trying to recruit a certain type of person to come buy a second home here, for example.
Rebecca, to the point of how difficult it can be to be in a really noticeable and small minority, you interviewed a woman named Angela. Tell us her story.
So Angela Grenier is a baker here. She's from Wisconsin, moved first to the Northeast Kingdom, and then later down into Wilder. What was striking to me about some of her stories is she moved from Wisconsin. And when she came here, she said it was the first time that she really understood what racism was. She never really thought of herself as white or black or a racialized person. Then she moved to Vermont and sort of understood what that meant. So here's Angela Grenier talking about some of her experiences.
I feel like when I moved from Wisconsin to New England, it was an awakening of sorts for me. I wasn't aware of my color as much as I am now. The first day that my daughter and I were in New England, we wanted to see our new town. As we're walking around, we were definitely aware that the neighborhood wasn't happy to see us. And within a half an hour, I was spit on and also experienced some neighbors who crossed the street to get away from us. The two of us talk about our experiences regularly. My daughter is 26 years old now. She was 14 when we moved. And again, it's been 14 years of her life not really having too many racially charged experiences. So when it started to happen to her, it rocked her world. It really rocked her to her core. And it's something that we talk about almost daily. She left New England the day after her high school graduation, vowed never to come back, and has not.
Anytime Angela and I have talked about these things, she sort of has welled up. And it's really heartbreaking because she's a really gregarious person, and it's not something that you would ever see. I see her all the time in my day-to-day, and she is engaged in her community and always seems to have a smile on her face. And then you hear these stories that, you know, maybe are bubbling under the surface that is not something that we talk about generally because it's painful. And she was really brave to talk about these things, I think.
Angela, in producing this episode of the Brave Little State podcast that included Angela's story that we just heard, what kind of feedback have you received from listeners?
I would say we've gotten a range of feedback. And I will say some of the comments on our story were pretty negative. A lot of people not sort of even comfortable with the premise of this question. People who felt like the episode vilified white people or that the episode was trying to create a divide that wasn't there. There were some people who said, you know, the Vermont I live in is totally accepting and great, and I think this is overstating things. And so those comments in and of themselves are pretty illustrative. And actually, just a few hours before we came into the studio to talk to you, Pete, we got one commenter who said, I'll tell you, these comments are really illustrating why is Vermont so white. And so there's like this resistance to even contemplating some of these harder topics, I think. Now, that being said, we also got a ton of positive feedback. People really, really appreciative of the people that Rebecca interviewed sharing their stories, some people volunteering their own stories. And some people were particularly moved by Angela Grenier's story, which we just heard. Actually, one group that got started recently to sort of provide support to people who have experienced hate reached out to us and asked if we could put them in touch with Angela so that they could say, you know, hey, we're here for you. And I know Angela was really moved by that.
Rebecca Sinanis is a VPR reporter in the Upper Valley, and Angela Evansy is VPR's digital editor and producer and host of the podcast Brave Little State. The episode that we have been discussing was created because a VPR listener asked the question, why is Vermont so overwhelmingly white? You can suggest questions to Brave Little State, too, and you might get invited to help report the story that answers your question. Learn more at VPR.net. Angela, Rebecca, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Pete.
And that's our show for today. There are bills in both the House and Senate promoting a state-run paid family leave program. It would allow employees to take paid time off when they need to care for a newborn or a sick family member. Monday on Vermont Edition, we'll hear why supporters think the program is necessary and why some feel that now isn't the right time for a mandated system. Send us your thoughts or questions about paid family leave to Vermont Edition at VPR.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Peter Hirschfeld. Have a great weekend.